Little square thing in the back of my shirt, that's the recorder. Okay. I want to start off tonight talking about what we are not exactly going to be talking about. I want to sort of lay out what we're going to be doing tonight. As you know, the whole purpose of this series is really to talk about the scholarly renaissance that's going on in terms of the learning of the Bible. Tonight's discussion of archaeology really isn't about archaeology per se. This is not going to be a thorough description of all the archaeological work that's been done over the last 100-150 years. We're going to talk about it a little up front so that you understand the context we're talking in. But what we're really talking about is the learning of the Bible. We're going to take two specific passages, which are... Okay, here comes another nerdy technical device. We're going to be taking two pieces of Torah and studying them and showing how understanding archaeology actually enlightens our study of Torah. So what we're really here tonight to do is to learn Torah, and we want to show some places where the learning of Torah and archaeology meet together, and the learning of the archaeology actually benefits our study of Torah. Okay. Before we do that, though, I want to give you just a brief, about a 3-minute little clip of video that does give you some background into the development of archaeology in the last, as I say, about 150 years. You have the, that.
For 2,000 years, the Bible was the only source of information about the history of the ancient Near East. Its text was accepted as a literal history whose accuracy was taken for granted. More recently, however, scholars have begun to refine their understanding of the biblical record. During the last century and a half, archaeologists have uncovered buried cities and deciphered documents thousands of years old, so that our knowledge of the ancient world and of the Israelites' place within this broader cultural context has vastly increased. While some still hold to the traditional view that the first 5 books of the Bible, known as the Torah, were given to Moses at Mount Sinai, most modern scholars believe they were compiled in the years during and after the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BCE, and that they reflect that period in many ways. Most agree that the Torah has a historical core of earlier texts and oral stories, which were incorporated by Judean scribes into a work whose purpose was to preserve and refine a theological vision of their nation's past. The evidence that has come to light in the century and a half of archaeological work sometimes corroborates, sometimes conflicts with, and sometimes is silent about the biblical account.
Okay, this is from the Heritage DVD-ROM, and it goes on. You can, because it's an interactive DVD-ROM, if you had it, you could sit and explore these different pieces of evidence. Now, what this piece was really talking about, this DVD-ROM is devoted to the study of Jewish history, and it's talking about the light that archaeology sheds on the study of history and the Bible as a historical source. Again, that's not necessarily really our focus here tonight, but it is important that we begin with it, because it sort of... You know that expression, the elephant in the living room, that you have to sort of talk about? There is that elephant in the living room, that many of the things that archaeology has uncovered brings into question or raises questions about the historicity of some events in the Bible. Now, for that reason, many people like to not look at it. Because it raises questions that trouble us, better to avoid it entirely. Put it aside. If it raises difficult questions, then perhaps we shouldn't engage in this field of study. It's safer to stick with what we've been doing all along. After all, you can definitely spend your entire life studying the Bible without accessing any historical or archaeological knowledge and keep yourself very, very busy. Scholars have been doing it for centuries, and they've left plenty for us to do more. You don't need it. If you don't need it, and it raises troubling questions, perhaps it's best to avoid it altogether. This is not an approach that's taken by the type of scholars that we are learning about in this 6-week series. In fact, thanks, Alan. Thank you. In fact, In particular, we're going to be focusing tonight on the works of Rav Yoel Ben Nun, who's particularly holistic in his approach to study of, well, I guess everything. I guess it would have to be. When he studies everything, he really comes to it with everything he knows. And I once heard him say a very, maybe it's too strong a statement, but I'll tell you what he said. What he said was, a question like that, why should we even engage in the study of archaeology, reminds him somewhat of the question of, why should I, in my religious life, relate to the modern state of Israel? Jews have been getting along fine without a modern state of Israel. We've been practicing the religion the same way all this time. Why should this event really impact me in any meaningful way? I can keep myself perfectly busy with Torah and Mitzvot. And to a certain extent, that's true. But you are missing a richer dimension of what's going on. You're cutting yourself off from a very important and powerful dimension of your religious life. And I think that both of these approaches, why should we relate to the state of Israel, and why should we relate to archaeology and history, come from a similar sort of mindset, which says, I don't look at reality and use religion to understand it better. I define reality by looking at religion. If my religious worldview says there shouldn't be a modern state of Israel, then I'm not going to pay attention to it. If my religious worldview defines the story of Noah or the Tower of Babel in a certain way, then that's my story and I'm sticking to it, and I'm not interested in what archaeology has to uncover. And the truth is that's really a shame, because you're losing an enormous amount of insight and richness that these studies offer us. As far as the questions, so there's questions. Jews live with questions. Okay, questions. Some are harder questions, some aren't such hard questions. Some will answer with answers, some will answer with more questions. We're Jews. We shouldn't be afraid of questions. The fact is, of course, that we've had questions on the Bible anyway, in the reading of verses, and archaeology has millions of questions on archaeology. Archaeology, it's similar to what Rav Zeideman spoke for those of you who were at last week's presentation. Just because these scholars may come at this material with certain conclusions about the Torah not being from a divine source or what have you, as was discussed in this piece of video, I can disagree about the conclusions. His archaeological findings are what interest me. His overall worldview is less important to me in my study of the Bible. And these are not things that should fill us with fear. In fact, Rav Yoel, whose work we're going to be looking at, has this little joke that he likes to tell about how reliable the study of history is. He says, you know, in the early years of the state, there were very important people in the state of Israel. One of them was Moshe Dayan, who we've all heard of. And another one was Yigal Yadin, who also hopefully we've all heard of. Both of them were important founders of the state, very involved in the military development of the state of Israel. Both of them were involved in archaeology, one somewhat more than the other. Rav Yoel says, imagine 2,000 years from now, a historian digs up evidence that says that there were two men, two different versions of this story. A man involved in the founding of the state, in its political development, in its military development, and its uncovering of archaeology. One was spelled Dalid Yud Nun, Dayan, and one was spelled Yud Dalid Nun, Yadin. Well, the historian will conclude, obviously this was the same person. There were two people with such similar names, with such similar professional lives. It must be that there was one person. It was either Yadin or Dayan. And somehow over the ages, the historical record erred. But he also says that's a perfectly likely scenario to occur far in the future. And historians will readily admit that that may be what we're doing here. So archaeology itself, the study of any science, is fraught with questions. I'm getting good nods from Hillel, which is a good sign from a science expert in the room. That's the way it is. So we shouldn't be afraid in our study of religion of questions, certainly not from science, which is also engaged in looking at the world through questions. And if that's not satisfactory, I'll do one more sort of, I guess not an apology up front, but we have historical precedent for the use of archaeology in the person of the Ramban. Rav Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides. The Ramban made Aliyah when he was already an older man. He was from Spain, but he moved to Israel. And when he was in Israel, he traveled all around to the different cities where there was Jewish habitation. One of the places he went was Akko. And in Akko, the elders there gave him a coin. And from the Ramban's description of it, historians think it was probably a coin dated to the first revolt against Rome, from like 66 to 70. The Ramban looks at the coin, weighs it, and says, son of a gun, this is a shekel. Rashi, I have a machloket, I have a disagreement with Rashi about the weight of the shekel. If this is a shekel, I'm wrong. And I must be wrong, and Rashi was right. The Ramban was never afraid, and by the way, the Ramban couldn't read what coin it was, because it was written in ancient Hebrew. So he went and he found some Samaritans, who he considered to be religious heretics, but they could read ancient Hebrew. So he asked them what it said. They told him, he believed them. He said, oh, well, if that's a shekel, and this is what a shekel weighs, Rashi was right, I was wrong, the archaeology confirms it. So there's nothing scary or frightening to the Ramban about the use of archaeology in Bible study. Now, as that video piece said, we've uncovered a tremendous amount of insight about the ancient Near East in general and the cultures that affected the Bible in particular. And before we get to Rav Yoel and his type of study, I want to talk about the other types of Bible study that use archaeology. And I want to give you a few specific examples. Cyrus Gordon, who's really the Bible in the ancient Near East, Cyrus Gordon is a scholar of ancient Near Eastern studies, that's his field, who wrote about how his studies impacted on understanding the Bible. Certain insights that he had from studying, I think his expertise is in Ugaritic, but Amarna, they've uncovered all of these scrolls and tablets and languages, and he has all sorts of insights into the Bible, and he felt, let me share it with the Bible reading audience. So as an ancient Near Eastern scholar, he's informing things on the Bible. Just to give you one simple example, we know, of course, in the story of Gan Eden, that the tree that Adam and Eve were not supposed to eat from was the Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Gordon says that when I looked at many ancient Near Eastern texts, what I saw is very often, when they say Tov V'Ra, good and evil, light and darkness, they mean not necessarily what they're talking about. It's possible, he says, that the text doesn't mean the tree of good and evil, a tree that bestows moral understanding. In ancient Near Eastern language, when you say good and evil, it's sort of like when we say in English A to Z. It means from here to there and everything in between. When they give two opposites, it often means the whole shebang. So that it really means the Eitz Hadaat of everything, he suggests. And he then rereads the whole story as really the ascension of man, that man goes from this naive childlike state to becoming his own thinking, intelligent being, and that puts him in a new position, and God has to set about a new relationship. It sort of changes how he reads the story. Now, sort of taking it from the other perspective, you have Nachum Sarna, who's a much more popular writer. I think he's a much more enjoyable read also, who has books on Genesis and Exodus, and he has a few different commentaries. He is really more of a Bible scholar who looked into ancient Near studies to see what light they shed on the Bible. So he's looking at it from sort of the opposite angle. And he also comes up with tremendously interesting insights. His major focus, at least in Genesis, is finding these similar stories. We've all heard about these similar flood stories or similar creation stories. And he studies what's similar, but what strikes him always is what's really, really different. What was the revolution that the Bible was bringing about? This anti-pagan polemic that comes out. And he says, if you read the Noah text and compare it to the other flood myths, you'll see a tremendous anti-pagan, anti-magic polemic going on here, sort of trying to change the worldview that they live in. And I'll give you one example. If you could shut the heritage. This should be the next slide. What are these? Ziggurats. We have uncovered in Babylonia literally dozens of these. Most major cities in Babel, in Babylonia, had huge structures built up towards the sky. This was a normal part of Babylonian city life. All of a sudden, Sarna says, hold on a second, you got to go look back now at the story of the Tower of Babel. This tower that's built up to the sky, that the people are all gathered around. Well, what does that mean? Why did they build these buildings? Well, if you look at why they built the buildings, they're very different in structure, some of them. Usually they're sort of step-by-step pyramids. There's usually a ramp or a staircase of some kind going to the top. And at the top would be a temple. And basically the idea of them, as expressed by the Sumerians who built them, was this was a holy mountain. A holy mountain, though not built by nature, but built by man. Man building his own mountain and putting the deity in the temple on top and constructing the city around it, so that man was very much, by this whole arrangement of the city and of the towers, of putting his world into a sense of order, with man's own initiative at the center. I build the mountain. I build the God. I put God on top. And here you have this story in the Bible, which really doesn't talk about the idolatrous aspect of it, but really focuses on the sense of arrogance in human initiative, sort of the dangers of civilization and city life. There's a two-sided coin to civilization and the evils that can arise with it if it's done with a sense of arrogance, without a sense of being beholden to God. And we also have this very funny pun in the story of Migdal Babel, the story of Babel, because we now know through the study of these languages, Babel, the name of the actual country, comes from the term meaning the gate to God. That these man-made mountains were meant to be... These man-made mountains were meant to be sort of like a... there are texts where it's referred to as a navel between heaven and earth. It's sort of the umbilical cord between heaven and earth, where they come together. That was the idea. Babel is the gate of God. And of course, the Bible sort of taken a stuck at it by calling... It doesn't come from gate to God. It comes from Balal. It's all mixed up. These are people who don't know what they're talking about. They don't even understand each other anymore. There's something very wrong going on here. And it's a corrupted society. There's something definitely wrong with it. And Sarna goes on and on and on. It's very, very interesting stuff. I'll show you one more, not because it necessarily adds insight to the class, but because I found it. So I think it's kind of cool. I feel a little bit like Matt Lauer because I want to say, hold on, let's watch the clip and I'll talk to you on the other side. This is, you can't really read it so well, a four-cornered Egyptian garment. The pictures aren't so clear, and the video is a little bit shaky, because I was afraid that the guards would catch me. This was filmed at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and you're not allowed to do this. And I had my camera in my bag, and there was no way I wasn't filming a four-cornered garment with fringes, with a blue fringe down the side. A single blue fringe. You can see my daughter in some of the video. It even has the neck cut like this. You can see the fringes here. And here's the blue fringe down the side. And it was worn by Egyptian royalty. Now, that's very provocative. Does that mean that that was just a style of clothing that was worn and God was saying to do it? Is this some sign of royalty and God is asking Jews to walk around in royal garb all the time? I don't know. We're left with questions. But it's a fascinating thing to see. I happened to come across it. I almost, like, killed my daughter because I was like, ah, look at that. And she's like, ow! And then luckily the guard didn't yell at us. Yeah. Well, that's one of those areas that we don't talk about so much when we're talking about archaeology and the study of history, because there's no clear record of that story. That's one of those silent areas. I don't know that the dating would really work out. Anyway, I think, if I remember correctly, it's from like 700-800 BCE, which would be after the Exodus story at some point. But it's something that it's worn by a young Egyptian royal boy. Yeah, you had a question, Chuck? Okay. Yeah, it's later than it would have been if it was Joseph. Also, the odds of pinning it down to the one, that would be cool, but... Not so terribly likely. Yeah.
If it was later than the Exodus, then it could have been
them copying us. Yeah, I guess. I mean, we don't know. We don't know. And the next problem is even of our people, I don't think ever thought of it. If I go back without a camera, maybe I'll point it out to somebody there. I don't know if they'll care. I was just all flipped out, and my daughter has a black and blue mark on her shoulder. But I got this cool video, and then I spassed it and ran. And then I ran around the museum trying to film different things because I got all excited about my little evil day at the museum. Somebody noticed me upstairs. They have this whole gate from Assyria, I think, from Ashur, and I wanted to film it to show in class from the 10 tribes, and then the guard caught me.
Nobody noticed the connection. Let's make a quick short note in one of those archaeological reviews.
Yeah, I doubt it. That would be cool. Okay. What I want to do now, though, is sort of close that part. Because that's what I was talking about that we're not going to talk about so much tonight. That's really cool. And it is. Is there value added in your learning of the mitzvah of tzitzit? Is there value added in your study of the Tower of Babel? I would say absolutely. I would bring this into a class. And I think it's worthwhile. Use whatever cliche you want. A picture's worth 1,000 words. Okay, I'm out of cliches. But the bottom line is, by seeing something like this, it allows you to concretize it. In particular, for me, the ziggurats. When you see something like that, it makes the story come alive in a real way, and it re-engages you in the story in a new, we learn this way. We learn through pictures and visualizations. Does it really change our reading of the text? Does it really help us with reading texts that we found difficult and now they're easier to understand? No, not so much. But okay, it's still very cool and very enjoyable, and I think genuinely value added. What I want to talk about tonight, and I hope we have time for both, is two examples where it's beyond a simple value added of the cool, you know, sort of perspective building visualization. I'm going to take two pieces from the Torah that are very difficult to understand, that the commentators bend over backwards trying to make sense of. And in the 20th century, Rav Yoel ben Nun in Israel says, well, hold on a second. Let's see what the archaeologists say. Let's reread the piece again, and you have a whole new understanding of the piece. So I'm not sure if everybody has a handout. I think there might be a few extra around here. If there aren't enough, please share. I apologize. And next slide. Just because I can, I put the text up here also, so if you want to look up here, you can. But it's down on your paper as the first source, both in Hebrew and English. Vayihi b'shalach paro et ha'am, v'lo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim, ki karovu. כי אמר אלוהים, פן ינחם העם בראותם נוחמה ושבו מצרימה. וישוב אלוהים את העם דרך המדבר, ים סוף, וחמושים עלו בני ישראל מארץ מצרים. Two simple psukim at the beginning of Parashat Beshalach, fraught with difficulty. The first one is not really our issue. A lot of the commentators want to know why the Torah is saying that Paro sent them out. Oh, now you're treating Paro like he's a nice guy, like he volunteered to send them out. That's not what just happened. Okay, interesting discussion. Not our discussion for tonight. What really troubles the commentators is the description of God's sort of... What is God doing? He's changing his mind. He had a plan A, he goes to plan B. He didn't take them by the way of the Plishtim. And that word T is going to be a difficult word because it's used different. It's a conjunction used in different ways. Ki it was close. Ki again, thanks. Amar Elohim, maybe the nation will see war and turn back. So he took them down through the Midbar, and the Jewish people were armed. So Rashi, I brought down the Rashis here. Rashi tries to explain this. The language is a little bit confusing. And the first thing we have to do is figure out what those keys mean. The ambiguous key is not helping matters at all. What does Rashi say? Key means the way we usually use it, because. God didn't take them the way of the Philistines because it was closer. Which seems like a strange thing to say. I know sometimes I don't like MapQuest because it gives me a longer route. We like to go the shorter way. What does Rashi say? V'noach lasum b'altar derech ha'mitzrayim u'midrashe agadah yesh harbeh. He didn't take them the shorter way, because it's not only the shortest way there, it's the shortest way back. Rashi continues, Birotam milchama, kagon, milchamet, vayered ha-meliki, v'aknani, v'chule, imachu derech yeshar, hayu chozrim, umayim, kishahakifam derech me'ukam, amru, nitna rosh v'neshuva mitzrayma, im holichim b'pshuta, alach ha-kama v'kama. Rashi says, what's going to happen? They're going to bump into, let's say they bump into a war like the one they have with the Amalekites. And they decide, we have to go back. Well, they came by this nice, short, easy way. They now have a nice, easy, short way to run back to Egypt. So God didn't take them that way. Why? Because it was so short. If it's so short to travel that way away from Egypt, it's going to be very short to travel back to Egypt. And God doesn't want to give them an easy out. He purposely wants to take them along a circuitous route because it will be harder for them to find their way back. And Rashi says, and when they see war, what do? They say, we all want to go back to Egypt. If they said that after the hard route, imagine what they would have said after the easy route. Now, of course, that's Rashi's problem. Well, it's a hard route. It's longer. Nobody could find their way back. They're really so afraid. And it's not like... Is that killing this? Okay. It's not like they don't run into war, because they do. If they really wanted to retreat, is anything really stopping them? So Rashi says the somewhat longer route. Go to the next slide. And give it a click. Ooh. Oh, I almost pointed again. Because this is what we're talking about. This would be Derech Eretz Plishtim. And this ends up approximately, we don't know exactly how they traveled in the desert, but they went something like this. One of these areas would be where they crossed. They went down here. They came back up here. So Rashi gives his answer that God didn't want to take them this quick, easy way. Anybody could find their way back. He wanted them to go this long, difficult, treacherous way. They'd be afraid to go back. Okay, they weren't. But it's better than nothing. You get the sense from Rashi. The Ramban then tries to take a different approach. The Ramban's problem is as much linguistic as anything else. He feels that the sentence structure should have been different. The Ibn Ezra also agrees with Rashi. Kitam velonacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim ba'avur ki karovu v'yinachamu v'yeshuvu el mitzrayim miyad. Rashi and Ibn Ezra read it as it's because it was short and it would run right back to Mitzrayim. Va'al dati imaya kedivrehem haya ki amar Elohim mukdam. Vayomar hakatuv velo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim ki amar Elohim ki karovu pen yinachem ha'am. It should read, if that's why, because it was so short, it should say, and God didn't take them by the way of the Philistines because it was close and he was worried. He says the sentence would be structured somewhat differently. What's the Ramban's answer then? The Ramban reads it and the English gives it away as although. In other words, even though it was the shorter way, God didn't take it. Why? The Ramban says, "Avah nachon shiomer velo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim, asher hu karov v'tov linchotam b'derech ahu, ki amar Elohim pen yechem ha'am birotam milchama v'shavu mitzrayim." Even though it was the shorter, better route, he didn't take it because of his fear that they would chicken out in a war. The tava milchama, what's this war? Says the Ramban, "Shiyelahem la'avur derech eretz plishtim, u'plishtim lo yitnum la'avur b'shalom v'yeshuvu l'mitzrayim." So if they walked up this way, they would meet the Philistines. And the Philistines would declare war on them. They would be afraid to pass, and they'd head right back. So even though it's the better route, they're not taking it. Because they'll hit a war here. Now the Ramban is still left with a problem. They hit a war with the Amalekim. How's he going to get out of that? Oh, and what happens if they go this long way? They're not going to see Plishtim. So they'll walk around war-free for a while. Eventually, they'll come up here. They'll turn up here. Okay, by the time they get up here, then they'll have the wars of Sichon and Og. But by that time, it's already years after Egypt. It's a long way, or maybe it wasn't originally planned to be years. But they'll have been along long enough that they'll be desert-hardened, not these wimpy, you know, slaves who are, you know, kneeling to their masters. They'll be desert hardened by the experience of wandering in the desert for a little bit, maybe not 40 years at the original plan. By the time they get up here and face Sichon and Og, the Ammonite kings, they'll already be less chicken. And besides, then it'll be very far away. Ah, the Ramban says, but I know what you're going to ask me. That down here, they also face war with Amalek. So what am I going to say about that? So he gives two possible answers to that. He says either the reason that would not make them turn back is the Amalekim were so vicious and so full of hatred that they would have chased them and picked them off as they ran away. So retreat was not an option. Or, says the Ramban, maybe it's because of Rashi's answer. Maybe by the time you get to around here, it's so far away it's too hard to get back. And you do have that fumbly sense at the end of the Ramban also. He's reading the words a little bit better. But you have that problem of that they did face war and they did want to turn back. Are you saying the only reason they didn't turn back was because it was so short? Of course, Rashi and Ramban are completely ditching three other problems, two of which I'll discuss with you right now. Both of them are sort of not addressing two serious problems. So Rashi admits that they faced this war, that the war the Pasuk is talking about is the war with the Amalekites. The Ramban says that's not really the war that God's worried about, that's a different war. What about back here? What about at Yam Suf? What about when they get to the Yam Suf and they turn around and the hordes of the Egyptian army are behind them? And they say, let's go back! What about that? And they didn't go back. Because God saved them. Rashi Ramban, I thought you said he didn't take them this way to avoid war on a short route. He took them the way down to the desert through Yam Suf. Immediately they see a war. Immediately they want to turn around. And they don't because God saves them. So that whole plan never came into being. And there's another big problem. Already from the very beginning of God's informing Moshe, when he meets him in the desert about the plan, he first meets Moshe at this mountain, and he says, I want you to know, through you I'll free my children, and you will all come down back here to the mountain where you are now, and they will all worship me there. Well, hold on a second. So the Rashi and the Ramban basically are saying that God should have taken them this way, but didn't, to avoid war, yet they bump into war here. And what about the fact that God told Moses that they had their first scheduled meeting down here? Now, why in the world would God... The implication is that they should have gone this way were it not for this war concern, and yet God told Moses from the start that they should go down this way. Down here? Not a lot. It's the Sinai Desert. Well, they cross the sea here at one of these junctures, right? This is their first military moment of fear where they want to turn back. And the way is very short. And then they travel down, and we don't know where exactly, but probably somewhere around here, to Har Sinai, where they received the Torah, which was God's plan all along. So he never planned to take them up here. What happened to our story? What happened to our reading? They have always been problematic. They've never really answered the question well. They're doing the best they can with the language at hand, but that's all they have, is the language of the text. And sometimes you need sort of a wake-up call from elsewhere. So, next slide.
Is that kind of reading that the route was all the way down south in Sinai? I thought there was some thought that it was like in Petra, Egypt.
Yeah, I just heard that last year from somebody. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the point. I mean, it's still, you don't go to Petra. You take the King's Highway to Petra. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But It doesn't matter. It's not. There's no reason for them to go on the Derech Eretz Plishtim. Yeah.
It's also a theory that they went down to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Again.
That's where we're going. Let's take a look at how we get there, though, through archaeology. We know that there's a road, this Philistine road, we have archaeological evidence of. This Philistine road, the Romans called the Via Maris. There were two major roads that you would get from Egypt, and we're talking now roughly like, let's say, the 12th, 13th century BCE around for the Exodus. To get from Egypt all the way over the Fertile Crescent and then to Mesopotamia, which I guess will be around, I don't know, where I am, sort of. You would have to take these two major roads. One goes up this way. The Petra Road goes up this way. We know, give a click. The Romans, who were very good at making roads better, we have this Via Maris milestone. What do we know about this road, this Derech Eretz Plishtim Road, at the time that we are talking about? We actually know quite a bit. On the east bank of the Nile, we have a complex, and this is really one of the big, if you're into Egyptology tourism, one of the big sites is this complex of temples in Luxor and Karnak. As you can see, it's right on the Nile. Luxor and Karnak are attached by this sort of, this sort of alleyway with these statues of lions. And a lot of it remains intact. I don't know if you ever saw, did you see the James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me? And there's that scene with Jaws, and he throws like a Volkswagen on James Bond. Anyway, that's there. They have this whole cool sound. The light show, it's a big tourism center. And by the way, it was in antiquity also. Roman and Greek tourists went there to see ancient Egypt even in those days. Why are so many things preserved so well in Egypt? So we know that's because of the climate. And although much of the color is lost, as in most of this ancient archaeology in general, we have these reliefs in the walls. And they are treasures. We've seen them, we're very familiar with them, from every encounter we've had in the study of Egypt or Egyptian art. They're depicting royalty, they depict everyday life, they depict warfare. And from them we have a tremendous amount of information. This one in particular is the one we're going to be interested in. It even has a little bit of its color left, but it's very faded. So what we're going to look at is, instead of looking at this, go ahead, is this is a reproduction of it in simplified black and white. This was uncovered, as was much of this site, by A.H. Gardiner, who's also the guy who uncovered King Tut's tomb. And Gardiner was able, through different means, to identify many of the geological representations in this picture. We have different, what's the plural of papyrus? Papyri? We have various papyri that describe it, and by comparing and contrasting, they were able to put together a pretty good picture. Here you have the Nile. I don't know if you can see, but there's little fishies and froggies and whatnots in the Nile. And then you have Egyptian warriors, you have people subservient to Egypt, and along the way, and again, you can see this is where one end ends. They sort of, it was linear, I just put it this way because it's easier to look at. If you look along the route, these are wells. Little tiny boxes with water and trees around them. And it goes all along the route. Some of them appear to be representations of natural lakes. Some of them appear to be more man-made. Around these sources of water, we have these towers or stations. Here we have a large one. This one's probably Rafiach. Anyway, how you identify them is a whole other story. And again, I am no expert in archaeology, and I said at the beginning, we're not going into an in-depth study of archaeology. This is representing what Mr. Antin was talking about. We know from this and other sources that the Egyptians had set up on this route, which was really one of the major financial arteries between Egypt and Mesopotamia, garrisons, little garrison villages with sources of water. And if you wanted to get down to Egypt, or leave Egypt and go to Mesopotamia, or even up to Upper Canaan, you would have to pass through these garrisons. It wasn't occupied by Philistines at that time, so the Ramban's conjecture that it was the Philistines who wouldn't let them through was incorrect. Rav Yoel ben Nun takes a look at this text, and he says, well, hold on a second. So what is it that God is worried about? Is God worried that they'll see a war and want to run back to Egypt? They do see war. They do run back to want to run back to Egypt. That plan didn't work. Perhaps, suggests Rav Yoel, what the psukim mean is as follows. What would happen when they got to this first station town? This huge horde of Jews going up to a garrison of Egyptian soldiers. What do? Well, they have permission. Vayehi b'shalach paro. Paro sent them. And so they have all the paperwork. They present their paperwork to the guard at the gate. He lifts the machsom, you know. He lifts the bar thing. And they all go through. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good day. They get to the next one. Here you go. Thank you. Thank you very much. They end up in Canaan. They settle it. And they always know who sent them there. They always know under whose authority they live there. And what happens the first war that they get into? Now that they are a vassal state of the Egyptian Empire, they will go back to Egypt for help. And we have documents of vassal communities living in Upper Canaan writing letters to the Egyptians, can you please help us deal with the Shi people who've come and inhabited this region and they're giving us trouble? Can you please send troops up to help us? This is a very real scenario. It's a scenario that God did not want. He didn't want them to return to Egypt, not necessarily physically. They weren't going back physically. He could see to that. He was worried that every time they saw war, they would go back to Egypt. They would turn and kiss up to the superpower to protect them from their enemies. Take a look at the psukim, says Rav Yoel. Turn to page 2. Look at this verse from Yeshayahu, from Isaiah. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are exceedingly mighty. But they look not to the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. It goes on and on in verse 4. The Egyptians are men. They're not God. Their horses are flesh, not spirit. Look at the next one, also from Yeshayahu. Woe are the rebellious children, says the Lord, that take counsel not of me, not of my spirit. They walk down to go to Egypt and have not asked my mouth, and take refuge in the stronghold of Pharaoh and take shelter in the shadow of Egypt. If you know the history of the time that Yeshayahu is talking about, in their difficulties with Assyria, they kept making allegiances with Egypt, hopefully to protect them from the Assyrian might. And Isaiah is saying, what are you doing? You're going down to Egypt? Look at Hosea. Ephraim is like a silly dove without understanding. They call into Egypt, they go to Assyria. Why do you keep turning to these empires for help when you have me, says God? Let's go elsewhere in the Torah itself. This is in Dvarim. It's the mitzvah of having a king. When you come into the land and you possess it and you dwell in it, you say, I will have a king over me. You set him over a king. In verse 16, only he shall not multiply horses, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord said to you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. God said to them, you will never go back to, you will never see the Egyptians again. Is it true? Was that the last Jew to ever see an Egyptian? It's the last Jew that saw Egyptians as masters. Clearly God is speaking figuratively. God is saying, I don't want you to look at the Egyptians in the same way ever again as you will today after I smite them at Yamsut. And when in their history they keep turning back to the superpower for help, God is troubled and the prophet is troubled. And of course we have the last one from Devarim. And the Lord shall bring thee back to Egypt in ships. By the way thereof I said to thee, thou shalt see it no more again. Part of the punishment that B'nai Israel will have is that when they are exiled, many of them will live in Egypt, and that is part of the punishment. God said, you shouldn't let that happen, and when they turn against Him, if you want them to protect you, then that's where you're going to end up living, in Egypt. Yeah.
What did those garrisons do? When Yeshua is fighting with the Jews,
did he
ever have to conquer Egypt?
By the time of Yeshua, the Egyptians themselves have problem with these sea people who come and inhabit it. That's the Philistines of the time of Shoftim. The Plishtim of Abraham's time are probably a different group of people. The Plishtim in the time of the Shoftim are these sea people who came, like from somewhere in the Greek Isles, came and took over that whole area. Egypt gets squeezed out, and they end up troubling the Shoftim all the way through to Shaul, all the way through to David, who finally puts an end. That's who we fight. So that the Egyptian, this is already, we're talking about, Yetziat Mitzrayim would already be in the late kingdom. So the Egyptians are on the decline as a superpower. But the language in these psukim, Rabbi Yoel says, is the same language we're seeing in Shmot. God didn't want to take them on the path of the Philistines because if they saw a war, they'd want to go back to Egypt. Go back to Egypt doesn't only mean the whole nation turning around and going back to Egypt. It also means turning to Egypt. And you should know that they left Egypt armed, so they should never have to think of that again. It wasn't talking about this war with Amalek or that possible war with Plishtim. It's talking about all war in the future. I don't want you to be a vassal state. You know what it's like? I want you to be like America, not like Canada. Right? When did Canada declare her independence from England? Yeah, they did. Was it 1982? They have the right. England gave them the constitutional. England gave them the right to work on their own laws and constitution, which they said thank you. They still have the Queen's, what is he, the Governor General, who sits in the Parliament. They still have her on their money. She's still their head of state officially. They still, when you take a civil service job in Canada, you swear loyalty to the Queen. Really? Maury?
Am I? Things are working out very nicely.
Yeah. It's a very, right?
You don't like the change.
You know what I think it is? I think it's that they wanted to be independent, but they're so polite, they didn't have the right moment to bring it up exactly, and finally in 1982, there was this sort of awkward pause, and they sort of jumped in with the, America took a very different route. And America as a country has a very different self-image and role in the world. Some would argue for the better, some would argue not for the better. The point is, there's a measure of independence in America, a sense of self-identity, which can't exist in Canada because it didn't break free. According to Rav Yoel's reading, God took them the long way. Why? So that they would fight the Egyptians at Yom Shuv. Or even if they backed up, they'd watch God. God made that confrontation happen. You want to see what Egypt is? I'll show you what Egypt is. Compared to me? Watch. He wanted that confrontation. He wanted them afraid of that war so that they wouldn't remain vassals to the Egyptian empire. They would become a free and independent and self-reliant on Yisrael. That's how Rabbi Yoel is reading these psukim. We have very little time. I want to jump to the next one. It shouldn't take us very long. Before we get to the mystery in the text itself, I want to point out to you this mysterious passage from the Talmud. According to the Talmud, in this quote, this is a section of Bava Batra that talks about who wrote each book of the Bible. We're not interested in the whole section. I brought a few because it's kind of interesting. What we're interested in is this section up front. What did Moshe write? Moshe Ketav Shifro, Uparsat Bilam, V'Iyo. Okay, so what's Shifro? What book did Moshe wrote his book, the section on Bilam, and the book of Job. What's his book? So either it's Devarim or all five, whatever. Eov, I think we know what Eov, we know what the book of Job is. He wrote Parshat Bil'am. What about the rest of the Torah? He didn't write the whole Torah? I thought he wrote the whole Torah. Oh, Bil'am is a different book. I didn't know it was a different, I thought it was the same book. It's a different book? It's the same, it's not the different book, right? But what happened? That's a very strange thing for Chazal to say, for the sages to say. He wrote the Torah, he wrote the story of Bilam, and he wrote Eov. To take a section out of the Torah and say Moshe wrote that, what does that mean? So what did most commentators say? Most commentators, well, that's the only section of the Torah that there's no Jews in the whole story. Not a single member of Am Yisrael appears. It's all from the other point of view. Unless you think that Moshe took the book and just slapped it in or found it somewhere else. This is from Moshe. This was dictated to Moshe and is included as part of the Torah. That's what it means. Rav Yoel says that may not be all that it means. It may mean something more. The story of Bilam has to be one of the strangest stories in the Chumash. Aside from just being overall strange, there are a few particular issues that are very bizarre. Here I've laid out most of chapter 22, because we come across our first major problem. What's the story? We know the story. Balak, the king of Moab, Moab and Midian are afraid of this nation that's coming and making trouble all along the east coast. Wait, can you hit the next slide? Because they've come up now this is an annoying horizontal view, but this is again, this is the Via Maris, the Derech Eretz Plishtim. The other way around is this way through Petra, the king's highway, and this is the way that they end up coming in the end. And as they're coming up to the wilderness of Moab, they begin to be scared and they call upon Bilam ben Beor, this person who's portrayed by the story and by the rabbis as a prophet. And they say to him, Balak sends him messengers. The messengers say, could you please deliver a curse on these people, you know, put the whammy on them? Balak says, I don't know. I mean, Bilam says, I don't know. I have to ask. Stay overnight, in verse 8. In verse 9, God says to Bilam, who are these people? Not sure why God doesn't know who these people are. In verse 10, God says they're sent by Balak. And they wanted me to put the whammy on these people coming out of Egypt. And God in verse 12 says, no, I don't want you to do that. Bilam wakes up in the morning and says, sorry, fellas, nothing doing. They go home. They get in trouble with their boss. The boss sends bigger shots to go back to Bilam. In 16, they bring him the message. We didn't just ask you to come. We also, didn't we mention about the big honor and the money and the whatnot? And Bilam says, well, I have to, even if you give me all the silver and gold, I can't do it. Let me go ask God again. And son of a gun, that night God says, okay. God changed his mind. Why would God do it? I thought God didn't. God does. Offer him money now. He does. I don't know. It's very strange. So commentators have to come up with reasons. He was allowing him free will that he could make his own sin. It doesn't sound like the way our stories describe Hashem functioning. Now take a look. It goes on in chapter 23. So we have the whole story with the donkey that we know. Also a somewhat odd story. Then he goes and he tries to curse them, and every time he tries, blessings come out of his mouth. We get to chapter 24. Bilam now begins to realize that God doesn't want him to curse Israel, and this time he doesn't involve himself in witchcraft. Did anyone mention anything about witchcraft up until now? Nechashim is a form of predicting. It's a form of divination. He's performing divination. I thought he was a prophet of God. What? How did this jump into the story? And here we have another mention from Sefer Yehoshua, when it's giving the list of the people defeated by Am Yisrael. In chapter 13, verse 22, it says, Bilam ben Beor ha-kosein, the wizard, the soothsayer, it says here. Well, I don't get it. I thought he was this prophet of God, and here he is, involved in Nechashim, involved in Ksamim. He's hearing alternate messages from God on different days. What kind of guy is this Bilam? Rabbi Wolf, could you... Up there, now this was closer to Petra, in Deir Allah, the archaeologists uncovered some very old documents, also from about the 8th century BCE. One of them they dug out in this sort of puzzle piece form, which they then constructed, like a puzzle, and turned into this. This is just the same picture from different angles. And you see some of the words here are in red, most are in black. And this is an ancient Moabite text. And I've put it down to you, the English translation. See, here we have an 8th century Moabite document that talks about, guess who? Bil'am ben Ba'or. 1967. Most people don't know about this. This is not a recent discovery. Bil'am ben Ba'or has outside verification. It is centuries after, so maybe it's the handed down story of Bil'am. But the people of the region had stories of Bil'am. Only in this story, he is a man seeing gods. Gods call to him at night. He says to people, gods have gathered together and the Shadayin have held an assembly and they have said to Shamash. He's deeply involved in idolatry. He is an idolatrous soothsayer who they call upon in times of national crisis to solve their problems through witchcraft. That's the record that foreign nations have of the story of Bil'am. This may not be our story of Bil'am. Bil'am already had a reputation as somebody who could save them from difficult situations. He built that over time. This may very well be another one of those times where he was able to build that reputation. But he also says we have to take a whole other look at this Bil'am text now. What did Chazal mean when they say Moshe wrote the story of Bil'am? Rav Yoel says, I'll tell you what it means. It means Moshe wrote it in his own language, or in our own language. Moshe took the story of Bil'am, a story filled with idolatry. He goes to one god, he says to stay. He goes to the other god, he says go. He does magic, it doesn't mention it. When he stops doing magic, it mentions that he stopped doing magic. He says, bring me all these cows to bring his sacrifices. He's doing every type of idolatrous witchcraft practice that he can think of. But the Torah doesn't want to talk. That's dirty language for the Torah. And so what the Torah does is it cleans up the story. It retells the story in monotheistic language. Of course, then it becomes a very difficult story to understand because it's full of inherent self-contradictions. But that's the only way to include the story, by cleaning it up. So when it says that Moshe wrote Parshat Bil'am, it means Moshe put it into Torah-worthy language. Now, if it was such a difficult story to write, why include it at all? And Rabbi Yoel is left with that question. And the only answer he has is a suggested answer. It appears in Sefer Bamidbar, in the Book of Numbers. What's happening in Sefer Bamidbar? Well, it's really one devastating sin after another. We have the Kivrut HaTa'ava, where they're complaining about the menu in the desert. We have these generic complaints that they make. We don't even know what they are. We have the episode with the spies. We have the episode with the rebellion of Korah. We have one devastatingly depressing story, one after the other, of the behavior of the Jews in the desert. If somebody came along, if one of the Jews in the desert, one of Moshe's buddies, put a passage in the Bible saying, but you should know, Matobu O'alecha Yaakov Mishkanotecha Yisrael, what would you say? You're right. That's very nice that you say that, but we're reading about them. Because we only see these particular incidents. What about the rest of their lives for the 40 years? What about their day in, day out? Were they nice people? Were they a wonderful generation or two? Well, if one of them got up and said we were, you know, that's whitewashing. But if this guy says they were great, imagine if an Ayatollah in Iran got up and in the international media said, the Jews are the holiest, most wonderful, terrific people on earth. If I get up and say the Jews are the most wonderful people on earth, eh. If a great rabbi got up and said the Jews are wonderful, okay, what's a rabbi going to say? If Osama bin Laden says the Jews are wonderful and yay Jews, whoa, that we're going to brag about, that we're going to show each other, that we're going to show people. There's not a rabbi who wouldn't use that in his Shabbos drasha that week, right? That's... not what we're talking about. But the fact is that Bil'am found himself in the situation of saying these things, and that you have to put in the book. It needs to be there. It's in a completely inappropriate language, so we're going to have to rewrite it in this awkward way. This is Rav Yoel's suggestion. It's not, you can't confirm that, but that's his reading. Now, why do I find these two pieces so compelling? We were talking about this today in the office. I think to me what's compelling is that they are an excellent reading of the psukim, of the verses. They're a tight, good reading. It takes these difficult verses, puts them into the context of other verses, and makes a lot of sense out of them. It's triggered by the awareness of archaeology, but it's not dependent on the archaeology. If you took away all this evidence and read the Psukim that way to me, it would still be a compelling reading. It would still be a compelling commentary. But it was because Rav Yoel has a very open, scholarly approach that allowed him to sort of think outside the box, which is something that he does so brilliantly and well. And that's really what we came here to talk about tonight. That in this series of discussing different revolutions in the study of Tanakh, part of this open-minded approach, part of this interested, I got to get my fingers into everything that relates to the subject, and even if I don't think it relates to the subject, I just have to know it because that will make me a better scholar, has led to this type of fresh reading, which in some ways Rashi and Ramban never could have dreamed of. They just didn't have the source material in front of them. The Ramban, when he would get his hands on source material, used it, as we pointed out earlier. Rav Yoel says, okay, now we've got this stuff. He'd be crazy not to use it. It's so enriching. It's so exciting. And it turns a whole new layer of Torah learning up for us, digging it up, as it were, not so differently than what archaeologists do to the earth itself. Thank you. Next week is Rabbi Adi Kron, who will be talking about another Rav Yoel insight, showing that even homiletic understanding of Torah really has to do with an in-depth scholarly understanding of Torah. If it seems daunting the way I'm putting it now, please don't be put off. It is fascinating and enriching, and you should really all come and see it. Oh, sure. Now I need a drink.
I'm not sure. The only thing about that last one is why does it need to be cleaned up? I mean, the Torah speaks about it.